Welcome to our new PR Week podcast episode with Arvind Hickman.
Hello, I'm Arvind Hickman and welcome to the PR Show. Wiley, the godfather of grime, has been permanently banned from Twitter, Facebook and Instagram for an anti-Semitic tirade over the weekend. But the social media platforms have faced a backlash for allowing scores of videos and offensive posts to be broadcast to Wiley's large audience for several days after they were initially called out. PR leaders are furious about Twitter and Instagram's delayed response to Wiley's anti-Semitic spree, and some have called for a zero-tolerance policy towards hate speech on social media. Others have suggested the PR industry can take a role in educating society about the scourge of anti-Semitism, which rears its ugly head far too often on social media and in society. Today, we are joined by industry leaders who say it is time to take action to combat anti-Semitism, and we're going to discuss how. Joining our panel is Ready10 founder and MD David Fraser, Ketchum MD of brand Sophie Rain, Frank founder and chair Graham Goodkind, and Tin Man Communications director Natalie Neve. Thank you for joining us. I want to start off, guys, by taking a deeper look at what has happened the past few days on social media. Sophie, I first found out about this through your understandably angry tweets. Can you take us through when you came across Wiley's post and how it made you feel?
Yeah, so I sort of was perusing Twitter on my phone, as I tend to do of an evening in front of the telly, and I started to spot some chat about what was going on. And then I started opening up his tweets. And it was really, really horrifying. Horrifying and terrifying in equal measure. I couldn't really believe that it was going on. And it seemed to have been going on for quite a few hours by this point. And it seemed to just be getting worse and worse as the evening started drawing to a close. Mm-hmm. I actually had a new Wiley's manager. He is a Jewish guy, and I'd worked with him sort of many years ago. He's been in the music industry for some time. So I reached out to him and I said, like, what the hell is going on? And he didn't reply to me. And then obviously the rest we're kind of all aware of. The anti-Semitic tirade just continued to get worse and continue to go unchecked. And, you know, it's although the platforms have taken action, for me it feels really incredibly late.
Okay. Can I just ask you, Sophie, do you have any sort of understanding of the context behind his anti-Semitic attacks? Is this something that he commonly does, or is there a problem with him, for example, and his manager?
So my understanding is that this has spouted as an issue that he's had with his manager, and I think they've got a history of kind of parting ways and getting back together. They've worked together for over 12 years. So I think it might have started as that. But I think fundamentally, you know, and David Fraser will attest, because we were speaking about it at the time, you know, this is not the first show of anti-Semitism from Wiley. It's actually been included in lyrics to certain songs that he's featured on. So although I think maybe perhaps it might have stemmed from a disagreement with his manager, you know, what it's turned into is clearly the airing of some extremely bigoted and abhorrent views that have been shared for everybody to see and left on for way too long.
Okay. David, I understand that you may have worked with Wiley, or he may have worked on a campaign that you were involved with in the past.
Yeah, I can come in there as well. So, well, there's quite a lot to this side of it. So I think saying that this is a dispute with his manager that's got out of control is letting him off the hook. We've worked with John Wolfe before as well. He's a very demanding character, and he knows what he wants. And members of our team will have, let's say, had the odd run-in with him. They've managed to not go off on an anti-Semitic tirade when we've had those discussions about Wiley's management and John Wolfe. So I think, I'm not in any way suggesting Sophie or anyone else was saying it, but if that's ever levelled as a kind of excuse on behalf of Wiley, I don't have any time for that. I was aware of some previous that Wiley had had. He'd collaborated on a song, I think, in 2017 called Get Paid, where he one of the lyrics was, I'll move like a Jew for the money, which is a kind of very centuries-old trope connected with Jews and money, which lots of people will be familiar with. I actually heard it randomly on a... I just happened to hear the track and thought, what the hell is this? And was aware of it. Then sometime later, a situation transpired where we were working with Wiley, and I kind of regret what happened, to be honest, because I was aware of it. I'm Jewish myself. I did bring up, well, you know, there was this incident where he collaborated on this track. And the long story short is we still continue to work with him. And I sort of, I kind of beat myself up about that continually, really, because I overlooked it. The people who I worked with overlooked it. Everyone kind of shrugged, a bit like how Twitter and Facebook did for this week. And I regretted it from that moment that we kind of went ahead with what we were going to do with him and wished that we hadn't. Now then, fast forward to now, months later, and this anti-Semitism, which has obviously been festering in him, rears its head, and now it's all out there. But yeah, I have my own personal experience of it that I've reflected on significantly.
Okay. Graham, you're also Jewish as well. When did you find out about Wiley's post? And what's your sort of views on how long it took?
I mean, look, I found out on it from Sophie, actually. And Sophie, who I follow on various forms of social media, I saw her getting very understandably irate about it just after the, you know, the comments came out. And I was as horrified as probably everyone was. I mean, in terms of, you know, so that was my first exposure to it. In terms of what I kind of thought about it, I mean, I couldn't believe that it took so long to react. I know Twitter have issued an apology saying, we are sorry we did not move faster. For me, that won't wash. Similarly, Wiley's comments about his apologies, where he said, I apologise for comments that were looked at as anti-Semitic. I mean, I don't think you need to use the words looked at, my friend. That's really not part of it. They were blatantly anti-Semitic. So I'm afraid his apology doesn't wash. And it doesn't matter for me what the reason for it. The excuse was he fell out with his business partner or he fell out with someone from work and then relied on blatant anti-Semitism. And then I don't know what's happened. The amount of people that fall out with each other in business the whole time, you know, every day is loads of people, but they don't resort to the sort of abuse that they had, you know, that he extended to basically all Jewish people, and, you know, trying to tar everyone with the same brush just because it's fallen out with someone. I mean, I'm passionately against anti-Semitism. The guys all know about it. I'm a bit older than them as well, and I've spent many years working with different Jewish organizations, basically looking at, I guess, the new frontier of social media being a place where anti-Semitism is perhaps more rife than anywhere else. But it's kind of not like social media is it should be like, I should say, what it is in real life. I mean, unfortunately, it's a fact of life that Jewish tombstones and cemeteries are often defaced. Swastikas appear on it. It happens, you know, every now and then, 7-8 times a year, you read about it in the Jewish press. The next day, by the next morning, I promise you, those tombstones are wiped and scrubbed clean. The swastikas are removed. I mean, it's a terrible thing to do, but it's dealt with within hours. I mean, and to say that Twitter and the other social media giants couldn't deal with it at that pace, I find, a sorry affair.
Okay. I want to bring you into the conversation, Natalie, because you're the only member of our panel that isn't Jewish. What is your view on what Wiley did and the way that the social media platforms reacted?
Well, obviously, I agree with the rest of the panelists that obviously Twitter was too little too late. But I think if you look at the number of followers Wiley has, he has 500,000 followers, versus the number of Jews in the UK, which is 300,000. It really puts the enormous kind of power that he has over these highly impressionable young people on his social media platforms into perspective. Looking at Twitter, Facebook and Instagram rules, they do have rules against anti-Semitism, but they just aren't doing enough to enforce them. And I really think they need to show more leadership on this front. Okay. I think what's interesting is that obviously talking about Wiley and what Wiley's he's done, it's brought this all to the fore. But I think it's really interesting if you look at the stats about anti-Semitism on social media. A post, an anti-Semitic post, is uploaded every 83 seconds, which is absolutely shocking. So Wiley might be suspended, but if it wasn't Wiley, there is a huge amount of anti-Semitic posts up there. I think 400,000 posts every year. This piece of research by the World Jewish Congress found that it takes an average of 3 months for them to be removed. So it's not just their policing of Wiley that needs to be called into question. It is just the kind of the amount of time that these platforms are taking to deal with this hate that is festering on their platforms is just unacceptable.
That's pretty alarming research, isn't it? It takes 3 months to remove anti-Semitic posts on average, and there's about 400,000 a year, possibly even more. Do you think that social media platforms are getting this wrong and that they need to adopt a more aggressive position, for example, a zero tolerance policy, where if you do post things that are anti-Semitic, you're struck out immediately?
Absolutely. I think if they take a zero tolerance kind of perspective on this, they can always review posts in retrospect. Having taken so long to act on this, those posts from Wiley were still up as of yesterday. That is unacceptable for 500,000 people to be viewing. And if you looked at the engagement that those posts were getting, the comments, it's actually so frightening. I think they can always review a removal of somebody's account, but you can't retrospectively look back and say, you know, posts with such vitriol were up for such a long time. I think they'd need to do more. It's absolutely unacceptable.
Okay, Natalie. David, what's your view on that?
I recognise we're slightly in danger of all the panellists agreeing on everything, but I totally agree. And I didn't know half of those stats that Natalie quoted there either. And I agree with you, they're shocking. The problem is with all these comments, anti-Semitism, but also racist comments, is there is not enough pressure being applied to these platforms to police them properly and to remove them properly. Now, if they were mainstream media outlets, if it was a message board on a national newspaper website, these things would be moderated pretty tightly and these things would be off there. But for some reason, social media platforms, as publishers, appear to fall into this gap where there isn't the pressure or the will from them to police them properly. And I think that has to change. I think it will change through two ways. It will change through pressure from financial partners and sponsor. But really the main change is going to be legislation and the burden falling on these companies to moderate them themselves. Because at the moment, the only driver for them moderating them is the kind of sense that they probably should. And that's why they have done it, but they've done it extremely slowly. They need a bit more of a push from the legislators, in my opinion.
The sad thing is that, unfortunately, the business models of these social media platforms are all based on engagement, and there is no financial imperative for them to police that engagement, even if it allows this bigotry and prejudice to fester. So once that changes, I think, like David said, there'll be more of an incentive for them to really take a lead on this rather than, you know, react to goodness knows how many million people on social media putting pressure on them to do something about it faster.
What I'd like to think that that's the other reason that they'll change is because more and more people will find these platforms less and less relevant to their lives and more distasteful. And obviously, you know, immediately after the comments were made, a lot of members of the Jewish community in the UK went on a 48-hour abstention from using different social media channels. And I think that will hurt the social media channels themselves. And I think, you know, with other subjects, look, the sort of abusive behaviour that just roams free on social media isn't just confined to anti-Semitism. Let's face it, we feel it as Jews in this country very closely, anti-Semitism, and it's a very, very open wound for us. And it's only a generation ago that many of our relatives and ancestors were wiped out, you know, as a result of it. But I think the more and more people that start withdrawing from social media and using it less, and I certainly use Twitter less personally than I ever did before, mainly because that it's allowed to run free and unchecked. And if the social media companies won't take their own action, if legislation won't happen, I just think that decent people will just not open them on their apps anymore.
Completely agree with you there. I think that, you know, consumers want to engage with brands and platforms that reflect their moral values. And if these platforms continue to kind of be a place where hate is allowed to, I don't know, but fester, then, you know, more and more people will start moving away from them.
And fester is a good word, Natalie. I think fester is the right word. Yeah, it's the right word.
Sophie, I just wanted to get your views on the zero tolerance thing and what should be done to social media platforms for allowing this to continue. Did you have any strong views on this?
Yeah, I mean, to echo a lot of what David said, really, I mean, the terrifying truth is that over the past decade or so, social platforms have essentially obliterated such a big chunk of newspaper journalism, yet refused to assume the civic and moral responsibilities of these publishing platforms that they've pushed out. And it's frightening because we're living in a world where conspiracy theories that were once kind of confined to the fringe are going mainstream. Hate crimes are surging, as are attacks on religious and ethnic minorities. You know, anti-Semitism is just a strand of that. I think Sacha Baron Cohen spoke recently and he said something that, you know, he put it beautifully, which was the social media platforms amount to the greatest propaganda machine in history. And it's slippery. I mean, I think David alluded to it, that Facebook and Twitter, they sort of say they're platforms, they're not publishers, which in my view is an incredibly disingenuous description designed purely to protect their bottom line, because they are making editorial decisions on a daily basis. You only have to look at what Facebook was doing during the pandemic, taking real action against fake news. They were flagging and removing misinformation. Twitter removed posts deemed to be glorifying violence, including posts from Donald Trump. So all of this kind of proves that they are accepting the legal and moral responsibility for the content they host. So they need to be doing the same thing, the same approach for hate speech. But I don't think it's going to happen. I really don't. I don't think these big money-making machines are going to do it properly. And so, therefore, there needs to be greater regulation and legislation in place that's going to compel them to. I mean, looking at it and what is coming, it seems like it's going to be 2022 before the government publishes the online harms bill. But it seems to sort of carry exactly what we need it to stop the scourge of hate speech. That would see a new regulator being introduced for social networks. The power to kind of fine those who fail to remove hate content, and they could be fined up to 4% of their global turnover. And also, fundamentally, what will hopefully, you know, finally elicit change will be that the regulator will have the ability to ban sites entirely. And to be honest, as the sad truth is, I think that these sanctions are likely to be the only language that social media companies will understand.
Okay, I just want to pick you up on what the industry might be able to do about it a little bit more, Sophie. I know when we spoke last time, I sort of flagged the idea, is it possible, for example, for agencies that work with clients, the clients that fund these platforms, to advise them not to use these platforms? I know it's a bit of a sensitive and sometimes awkward conversation, but do you believe the industry has a role to play to help put pressure on these platforms to change?
I mean, you can see that is happening. I think it was last month that, you know, 500 or so companies partnered up to stop advertising on Facebook until they did something about hate speech. So it does feel like there is a movement towards it, where brands are taking, you know, the matter really seriously and threatening to, you know, stop spending with them. I think the reality is, although I think Twitter saw a dip when this ban was in place, that they've soon sort of made the cash back up when the green light's gone again. So, you know, I think in a nutshell, you know, brands and consumers, as we've seen, may stage, you know, these boycotts. But I think fundamentally the only route to change is going to be via greater regulation and legislation.
Okay, does anyone else have a view on that, on whether the industry can play a stronger role in advising clients to spend their money elsewhere?
If I can come in, I think the kind of vitriolic hate speech is only one part of the problem. And there's quite a lot of echoes to this argument of the types of arguments that were put forward a month, 6 weeks ago, when there was lots of discussion, when you guys hosted a podcast around issues like Black Lives Matter. People, the vitriolic racists like Wiley, that everybody knows Wiley is a Torag. Everybody knows where he is. In a sense, he's not the problem because he's very easy to identify. The people who spout far right kind of hate, we know where they are. And yes, it's a given that this needs to be dealt with quicker. But the other part of it is the microaggressions that exist, the tolerance to anti-Semitic views, the way that normal good people let them kind of slide, and that they are just allowed to, as Natalie said, fester. And so whilst, yes, there does need to be a lot of regulation on the stuff that is very clearly has no place on a platform like that, there needs to be a lot of education. Where I think the PR industry can help is anti-Semitism has become rather complicated, probably too complicated, a thing for a lot of people to understand, when really it needn't be. It's, you know, if you boil it down, it's discrimination against Jewish people, but it's wrapped up in so many other issues, and it's owned by a certain part of the kind of the intelligentsia that talk about this issue, that actually I think it's very confusing for people. So whilst I think there's a job on the Wileys of this world with the making sure that content isn't given space to breathe, I think there is a big job to be done on educating people about what anti-Semitism actually is, breaking it down, making that message clearer, and communicating with people in a way where they understand it and where they don't stand for it and they don't just allow it as well.
I want to touch on education in a short while. Just to begin with, I just want to sort of ask you guys about your lived experience and some of the things that you see, anti-Semitic things that you see and experience. Perhaps I'll start off with you, Sophie, and then I'll go to Graeme and then Natalie. Can you just sort of help give us a bit of context, understanding about how pervasive anti-Semitism is today?
First of all, I'll start by saying my mum had some really deep concerns about me doing this podcast in the first place because she was worried that I would get targeted. So that gives you a flavour.
Mine too, by the way, Sophie, just so people understand, I had exactly the same conversation with my parents.
David and I were talking the other day, you know, you spend your whole life as a Jewish person deciding if and when you should disclose the fact that you're Jewish. Sometimes it feels safe to do so, and other times you keep it hidden like some sort of dirty secret. And when I was researching for this podcast, you know, what's sad is that David and I are not alone in feeling like that. 73% of Jewish people admit to hiding things that identify them as Jewish out of concern for their safety. And, you know, I think Graeme and David and I will tell you that actually when you stop and you sit and you think about anti-Semitism in your everyday life, you realise how prevalent it is. You know, comments have been made my whole life from things that perhaps don't seem offensive on the surface, be it about being good with money or saying some people would say that I didn't look Jewish. From sheer ignorance, the amount of times people have asked me whether, you know, we have sex through a sheet. To really horrific, extreme instances that have happened to me in my lifetime. I've been on a group email where someone made a joke about a gas chamber. I've had an electrician come to my home who told me that my house smelt of Jew. And these are just a snapshot of things that happen. And, you know, obviously, as you'll go in and you'll ask David and Graeme about their experiences, I fear that they are going to echo what I've said. And that's a really, really sad truth. You know, anti-Semitism is on the rise. Hate crimes as a result of anti-Semitism are on the rise. And it's a terrifying truth to share.
Okay, David, do you want to jump in before I get Graeme to share his experiences?
Yeah, so the couple of things that I think may surprise a lot of people who haven't had to think about this too hard is, first of all, it's a real and present thing in my life, and certainly is for a lot of Jewish people. My grandmother, who sat in my garden on Sunday afternoon, is 100 years old, and she had to come here as a refugee at 20 years old. She still doesn't know what happened to her parents in the Holocaust. We believe that they died in Auschwitz, but we still don't know that. That is something very real for me and my family that you can touch. This is not a historical thing for people. Now, people can then think, well, that was a one-off. It wasn't a one-off. The Jews have been persecuted for a long time, and I won't give everyone a history lesson. But as it happens, on this day in the 13th century, Jews were expelled from England, and there are dozens of examples of Jews being persecuted. So this is not a new thing. So when Wiley says some of the things that he said, this has a lot of echoes and brings up a lot of fear in Jewish people. I have had the same comments that Sophie has had that perhaps Graham will echo as well. The terrifying thing for me is that it has become mainstream in the last few years. These comments have got a voice, perhaps through social media platforms. And perhaps I know there will be people who listen to this podcast that won't like what I'm about to say, but people like Jeremy Corbyn and the previous incarnation of the Labour Party becoming mainstream has, in my opinion, made these issues mainstream. And that is what is so terrifying. It feels like it is increasing, not decreasing, as far as anti-Semitism is concerned.
Graham?
I guess my experiences are similar. As I said before, I'm a bit older than the guys, and my experiences of anti-Semitism, for me, started actually on campus. With what just David just said about sort of the far left, and I call it the intellectualization of anti-Semitism, and I encounter a lot of problems on campus just trying to, with the Jewish society that happened to be on my campus at the time, and it getting attacked and banned by the far left. You know, this was 25, 30 years ago. I made a determined effort to fight it then. There used to be something at the time called the Anti-Racism Alliance, which was against all forms of racism, obviously. And I used to go on their marches and be involved in some meetings there. So I've always been one to fight racism and particularly anti-Semitism all my life. I do see it on the increase. If you look at the stats from the CST, the Community Security Trust, who are the security organization for Jewish people in this country, all the stats point to a massive increase, both in physical acts as well as in acts on social media. You know, my kids recently, they left school, but when they were at school, when they went to a Jewish school in Hertfordshire, near where we live, the security at that school and at most Jewish schools around this country is unbelievably sophisticated, with Israeli normally trained security guards outside. They've received training in it by the Israeli army to protect them. My kids are used to doing drills in school for any instance where there's incursions on the property, alarm codes, alarm signals, what to do, where to run, where to hide, how to behave. And this is the stuff that Jewish people in this country are living with today. And personally, more recently, for me, I've seen it on social media probably unwisely. If I see friends of friends, and I use the term friends loosely, indulging in anti-Semitic behaviour, I tend to engage with them. And it's kind of a bit, for me, it's hand-to-hand combat for me on social media. And I'm big enough and old enough to be able to handle myself. But some things just push me beyond the point of being able to keep my mouth shut. And Jews have been very good at keeping their mouth shut and not speaking out against anti-Semitism. I think it's good now that we're having a panel where we're not doing that. I think also, just to finish, is that I think actually the PR industry has been a beautiful safe haven for me, and having, you know, spent my entire career within it, I haven't really encountered any anti-Semitism from other people and other agencies, other people involved, forms of media. I've never really felt it within our industry. So I guess, you know, that's a good thing. But once you kind of, and that's maybe because there's a lot of intelligent, well-lived people who kind of like mixing with lots of different people and get that. I don't know the particular reason why, but I've always felt very comfortable and at home in the PR industry as far as being Jewish is concerned. Unfortunately, in other aspects of life, not so much. And it's getting worse.
Natalie, you mentioned prior to this podcast that you had actually experienced or observed anti-Semitism in your working life. Do you want to share some examples there?
Yeah. So obviously I'm not Jewish, but I feel really passionately about involving myself in this podcast. And like David and Sophie said, I was advised by so many people not to participate, with comments like it's a minefield or oh, you're brave or careful, you might get backlash. But that's precisely why I wanted to participate as a non-Jewish person, because I think it's really important that the non-Jewish community ally with the Jews and just help raise awareness and educate people about what is going on. So Tin Man was founded by Mandy, who is a Jewish woman. And I think we were founded 7 years ago, and we have come up against quite a lot of anti-Semitism. And like David said, it's not the, you know, hate that Wiley is spewing. It's the microaggressions and the unconscious bias, which is kind of thinly veiled as a funny comment or a joke.
Can you give us some examples?
Yeah. So, for example, we've had a comment from a prospect, a new business prospect, that when we were costing up a campaign because our founder is Jewish, that we were in some way greedy or charging more. We worked with a number of different app developers from Tel Aviv. Obviously, Israel is one of the world leaders in tech innovation. But some industry people suggested we won those clients purely due to our Jewish connections and not due to our own merit and the kind of strength of our pitch, which is highly offensive for a number of reasons. I have stories from junior members of staff who have been so reluctant to put where they live, so North London, on their CV or their surname, for fear of employers thinking that they come from wealthy families and don't really need a job. And even one of our other directors, who has a Jewish surname, has had so many times, well, you don't look Jewish, or had, you know, a raised eyebrow when they eat a bacon sarnie after an awards do, almost like they, you know, there's an implication that they can't really be that Jewish if they're eating pork. I think it's just these small microaggressions that people just don't realise are anti-Semitic. They are just so ingrained in the way that society thinks. They're shocked when you actually pull people up on them and say, actually, you know, what you're saying is wrong. And it amounts to all kinds of libel.
What people fail to understand sometimes is it's a very particular form of racism, anti-Semitism, in that it's very, people understand with other forms of racism that that's oppressing a minority. Often with anti-Semitism, it's what people call punching up racism. So the Jews are the kind of old, the traditional tropes are Jews are in power, Jews have money, Jews are responsible for kind of the evil in the world, Jews are clubbing together to run the world. And the things that Natalie is saying, I recognise all of them. I don't even notice them so much. But and that's why they do need to be called out, because I think a lot of other people, like she says, when people are pulled up on them, they're quite shocked, because it's far too endemic, I think, for people to recognise properly unless they are pulled up on them.
Okay. I think I agree with you, David. I think there is a perception problem with anti-Semitism. I do think, you know, reading lots of articles over the weekend, there's a huge community of people and a body of thought that wants to rename anti-Semitism as anti-Jewish racism, because people understand race in the context of racism slightly better. And if you look at the definition of a Semite, it's kind of confusing. It includes both Jews and Arabs. And even in Wiley's apology video that came out today, and I use the term apology loosely, he doesn't even understand what anti-Semitism means. He still claims he's not a racist before then repeating all the racial stereotypes and generalizations about Jews controlling the music industry. I mean, just to put it in perspective, I mean, I don't have a huge social media following, but I am quite active on Instagram. I have 4,000 followers. And I posted about Wiley over the weekend and how strongly I felt about it. And I lost 1% of my followers. So whilst, you know, I don't have a huge amount of followers, consider that statistic when you're looking at, you know, these huge influencers who will happily post about Black Lives Matter. won't post about anti-Semitism. And I reached out to some of them and I said, why on earth would you post happily around when, you know, Ireland legalized same-sex marriage or your Black Lives Matter, but why won't you stand up against anti-Semitism? And they are just terrified that their fee-paying clients, their brands, will not want to work with them because they believe it's a political issue. And I think it's a re-education piece needs to be done, that this is not politics. It's a scapegoat to say that, you know, anti-Semitism is closely wound up in politics. I think it's an issue with society, and I think people just need to understand that.
Okay, I really want to sort of touch on what the PR industry can do to help educate or some other ideas. Sophie, do you want to sort of kick off some ideas on what you think the industry can do to help tackle this?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm kind of with the guys on the confusion around anti-Semitism, and that's probably one of the biggest issues to tackle it. That separation from racism is essentially perpetuating this us and them dynamic between Jews and non-Jews, which is thereby feeding into the very foundation of racist treatment of Jews throughout history. So it's a bit of a sticky situation, but I do think, and you know, when we spoke the other day, Arvind, I did say that, you know, I did feel we were an industry of amazing storytellers, an industry that consistently is able to kind of ideate and execute campaigns that can drive really significant positive change. And everyone on this call has been a part of those. And even just, I was judging the PR Week Awards a couple of weeks ago, and you know, the amount of work that people are showing up that can really make a difference. It made me feel like if anyone could try and take it on, then our industry would have a good chance.
Okay, I just want to get David and Graham's views on this before we wrap up.
Yeah,
David.
Okay. So the first thing, I appreciate we've only got a few minutes left. And Israel's not been mentioned. And I think it's quite important just to touch on that, because I understand why people say this. They always have the same question, which is, can you criticize Israel and not be, explain the separation between criticism of Israel and criticism of Jews. It's very simple and it does get confused. Yes, you can criticize Israel and the actions of Israel. It has got nothing to do with anti-Semitism. It is when you equate the two that there is a problem. So yes, you can object to the actions of Israel and still not be anti-Semitic. But that sort of points to kind of what needs to be done. The message needs to be simplified and explained better. I actually think what Natalie's talking about, the movement to change, to redefine anti-Semitism as anti-Jewish racism, will help in that explanation and help on that journey. And communications professionals can do that. The other thing is, actually, it's not rocket science. It's the same stuff that was said on similar podcasts around Black Lives Matter. How do we make sure that we make a change? It's very simple. Educate yourself, read up on it. Don't keep asking us to explain it to you, because we don't always know all the answers, we being Jewish people. Educate yourself on these issues and why they're issues. Get the people around you to educate themselves. Call out these aggressions, microaggressions, and anti-Semitic occurrences when they happen, and have a zero tolerance attitude towards it. It's as simple as that. I think they are some of the things that the PR industry can do. I also think there is, like I've said all along for the last three quarters of an hour, there is a big job to do around educating about this issue, and that can be done through communications and communications campaigns. And there's plenty of charities and education organizations out there that would be grateful for people's help on that.
Okay. Graham, you've got a few minutes. Final word.
Thank you. I mean, yes, you can rebrand it if you like, but I think for me, around anti-Semitism, I think we've got to educate. I think that's the way, certainly in respect to the Holocaust, in terms of addressing the lack of knowledge and information about that, has been very successful over the years in terms of educating people about what the Holocaust was. Things like the Holocaust Educational Trust, the Yellow Candle Project, are all brilliant ways of changing people's views and opinions. And I think maybe, as it's a PR podcast, maybe Jewish people need to do a bit of a PR campaign for Jewish people in this country. Maybe we take it for granted a bit that we know we're not all doctors, dentists, lawyers, or whatever, like maybe perception would have us believe we are. And there are plenty of Jews in this country that are being a force for good in society. There's people in all sorts of jobs and roles doing some great things for this country and being good, normal citizens. And maybe it's time that we need to be a bit proactive as a Jewish community to illustrate how we are part of the fabric of British society, how we are a part of this world and kind of just generally normal people who just have a religion that might be slightly different to someone else's, but that's all, we're normal people, and either accept us or get lost. And I think maybe that sort of message might be quite powerful coming from the Jewish community.
I just also, one last thing, I saw, I don't know if any of you guys saw, but a campaign went live yesterday in the US called hashtag No Denying It, where it was Holocaust survivors making personal appeals to Mark Zuckerberg to take down posts regarding Holocaust denial. So from looking at how we can make an impact on the social platform and certain, you know, things that are not legislated, I think that's quite a powerful idea.
It sure is. And I really look forward to seeing what the PR industry does to help better educate people about anti-Semitism. It's definitely something that we all need to stand up for. I'm afraid that's all we have time for, but I'd like to thank Sophie, Natalie, David and Graham for joining us and our production partners, Marketeers. If you enjoyed this podcast, please visit the PR Week website and support our journalism. This podcast will also be made available for free. It won't be behind our paywall, so please do share it as well. On behalf of the PR Week team, until next time, I'm Arvind. Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to the PR Show podcast with Arvin Hickman. Brought to you by PR Week. If you like what you heard, please leave us a nice review.